This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Today marks the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. military outpost in Hawaii. The attack quickly pulled the United States into World War II. What did that entry look like into Seattle and the Pacific Northwest? Felix Bonnell takes a look back 75 years ago.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
While the attack on Pearl Harbor remains a well-known chapter of American history, one aspect of the immediate aftermath is now mostly forgotten. On the West Coast, with its proximity to the Pacific Ocean and Japan, the fear of further strikes by Japanese aircraft created panic. In one notable case, the fear of a Japanese attack was so intense it led to chaos and destruction on the streets of Seattle. Local radio provides one of the most chilling artifacts of that time. As part of a defensive blackout, all lights were ordered shut off to make it more difficult for enemy planes, feared to be waiting off the coast to board aircraft carriers, to identify potential targets. This is a broadcast from Seattle station KIRO, just hours after Roosevelt's war declaration.
That blackout is not only for the city of Seattle, it includes every light between the California border, or rather the Mexican border, and the Canadian border. Every farmhouse, every light of any kind in that area must be out by 11 o'clock.
As part of the blackout, West Coast radio stations were also ordered off the air to prevent the enemy from using radio signals as direction finders.
It's almost 7 o'clock, 5 minutes or 5 seconds to go, and we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, with information when ordered by the United States Army Interceptor Command here in Seattle.
And then, silence. At least for a few hours. Until violence erupted in downtown Seattle that made front page news across the country. The danger and destruction came not from Japanese saboteurs, but instead from homegrown hooligans who took it upon themselves to enforce the blackout. The melee began at 4th Avenue and Pike Street. Just after 11 p.m., a crowd started heaving rocks and cans at the neon sign of a clothing store that had remained alight past the deadline. The rioters then moved down the street, shouting, "Turn them out! This is war!" as they smashed the windows of a jewelry store, a shoe store, and a movie theater. All because small interior lights could be seen from the sidewalk.
Dim the lights. Wait for information. Most of all, obey your air raid warden.
The group broke windows and did other damage to a total of 14 businesses before the riot was broken up by police just after midnight. One newspaper reporter described the mood of the Seattle rioters as patriotic ardor, a sentiment which might also apply to the post-9/11 world. Then, as now, wars rage far away against a mostly unseen enemy, and folks here on the home front sometimes get a little anxious. As it turned out, the Japanese threat to the West Coast never materialized. There were no aircraft carriers and no planes. The Seattle riot showed that the only thing we really had to fear was ourselves. I'm Felix Bonnell for This Not Just In.
December the 7th, 1941. On December the 7th.
During World War II, President Roosevelt called on the U.S. to be the, quote, arsenal of democracy. In Seattle, people did their part by building B-17 bombers. Thousands of these flying fortresses blackened the skies over Europe. And thousands of young men risked their lives in these planes. The B-17 changed history, but it also changed Seattle. EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern has the story.
Almost 7,000 B-17s were made at the Boeing Plant 2 facility on the banks of the Duwamish River. More than were made anywhere else in the country.
In huge Boeing plants, out of tough metal, they forge America's fighting bomber.
The Duwamish River, which runs through the heart of Seattle, became a hive of industry. 30,000 people worked at Boeing's Plant 2 facility, churning out up to 15 B-17s per day.
The system turned out more production per square foot than any other aircraft factory.
During World War II, you would have just seen lines of aircraft in various stages of assembly.
John Little is a historian at the Museum of Flight in Seattle.
You would have heard the constant chatter of rivet guns, of drills. It would have been a very noisy place.
Now, the last survivors of World War II are slipping away, and there are only a few B-17s left. One of them is at the Museum of Flight. It was refurbished in the spring of 1998. John Little told me about one of the first days the public was allowed on board. A volunteer by the name of Pete Graven was sitting in the cockpit, you know, keeping an eye on things to make sure nobody broke anything, when an older man came in and sat down in the pilot seat. And he closed his eyes and he reached for the controls. John said Pete was going to stop him, but he realized the guy wasn't actually touching the controls. His hands were hovering right over them.
And then he noticed that the guy was flipping the switches in the imaginary switches in the correct order for a pre-flight. So Pete asked, you've obviously done this before. And the guy just nodded his head, didn't say anything, didn't open his eyes. Pete then asked, how many missions? The guy said, 35. His eyes still closed. Pete then asked, any bad ones? And the guy, at this point, a tear starts to come down out of the corner of his eye. And it's still kind of hard to talk about, but he looks at Pete and says, yeah, 35, sole survivor. And it turned out that this guy had been the pilot on a B-17 who had lost his entire crew on the 35th mission. He was the only guy who survived. And he had been living with that guilt. And he had been diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. He was 73 years old at the time. And the one thing he wanted to do was to sit in the left seat of a B-17 one last time. Sorry, but it's still hard to talk about this because he said that's where he made the greatest contribution to the human race. You know, back in 1944, 45. So, you know, it reminds you that these aircraft are more than just pieces of metal. They are, to a very large extent, monuments to people who have no other monuments.
Making thousands of planes left a mark on the city of Seattle, and on the Duwamish River in particular. In a way, the river was sacrificed for the war effort. Smokestacks sprouted up all along this urban waterway, and it's a Superfund site now. It's undergoing a major cleanup. Boeing's plane construction contributed to the pollution in this river. The giant Plant 2 facility used to stand on the eastern bank near the South Park Bridge. Sean Blocker is the guy overseeing the cleanup for the Environmental Protection Agency.
This stretch is the most contaminated stretch of the Duwamish. Boeing Plant 2 historically had a lot of contamination that originated from the manufacturing processes up there.
When workers finished machining parts for the Boeing planes, they'd be covered in gunk and grease, so they'd dip the pieces of metal in swimming pool-sized concrete tanks of solvents to clean them off. Over the years, the tanks leaked metals and PCBs, the kind of contaminants that stick around for a really long time and get into the food chain so fish aren't safe for people to eat.
So this is almost like a timeline going back in history, showing more and more and more and more PCBs coming out of Plant 2.
Today, things along this stretch of river look a lot better. The shoreline behind Blocker is dotted with newly planted shrubs and grasses. Boeing has removed more than 200,000 cubic yards of polluted muck from the site, though there's still work to be done. The Boeing company has been criticized by environmentalists and tribes for attempting to weaken state water quality standards. But Blocker says on this particular cleanup, the company has done a good job. Sean Blocker has a personal connection to the Boeing cleanup.
My grandfather was a tail gunner on B-17s. He flew in the 15th Air Force and was pretty much with campaigns through North Africa and into Italy for the 15th Air Force.
Does that change the way you see the pollution that came from this place?
Not even a little bit. I think it connected me a little bit for the fact that it felt good to clean this facility up because it was crucial to World War II. It was crucial to my grandfather because that's what he did. So I get the other end of it. I get to clean up what got started during his era.
I'm Ashley Ahern in Seattle.
This story is part of our new Earth Fix series, exploring the relationship between the U.S. military and the environment of the Pacific Northwest. You can check out more photos, video, and our interactive documentary at KUOW.org. Coming up, a discussion on the future of the state's Democratic Party. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. Bond Humerman is here live tweeting at KUOW. After Hillary Clinton's surprise defeat in last month's presidential elections, Democrats across the country have been doing some serious soul searching. In Washington state, it's happening in school gyms, community centers, coffee houses, and libraries. That's because the state Democratic Party is in the middle of its own election for local party leaders and soon decisions on leadership of the state party. So what do those conversations sound like? We're going to hear from a diverse group of party activists in just a moment. But first, Jackson Ravens. He's the current chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. I asked him how he's been feeling about the election of Donald Trump.
It was horrifying. I mean, it was horrifying, and I, along with many other people, went into shock, I think. But right now, I feel like I'm fired up, to be honest, because as I see the cabinet appointments that Trump is making, you know, I realize that we've got a lot of work to do, and I'm excited about that. I talk to people on a daily basis who are also excited. So it's going to be hard work, but it's got to be done, and we're ready to do it. So Democrats and progressives are ready to stand up and ready to get to work, damn it.
Well, let's talk about what happened in Washington state locally. How do you think the state party performed on election night?
Well, let's talk about just Democrats and Republicans in general here. What were the Republicans trying to achieve this year in Washington state? What was the Republican Party trying to achieve? They were trying to get a majority in the state house. They were trying to increase their majority in the state Senate. They're trying to unseat Governor Inslee and unseat Senator Murray, and they were working hard to defeat the minimum wage initiative and also the transportation SD3 and also the guns initiative. And they failed on all those accounts. So I think the fact that the Republican Party on the state level did not achieve any of those of their main objectives is a sign that that we did well. And I temper that because it's not it's not across the board and it's not in all parts of the state. But I think the fact that we won 7 statewide executive races, we maintained our majority in the House, we picked up a seat in the Senate, and we passed some really important initiatives is big. But I don't say that in the sense that we're wow, that was great, that we're going to rest on our laurels or even that, you know, because there are other races in the state that were not as great. We did not do very well in some county races, but we did not expect to see the turnout of Republicans at the very end. If you've been tracking this much, you'll notice that there were a lot of Republicans, low propensity voters is what they're called, voters that don't vote very often, that turned out to vote at the very end of the race. And, you know, we just saw a ton of votes coming in for Republicans. We had not seen that before, and we haven't quite figured that out yet, why that was the case.
There are some critics within the party who say that the state party is not doing a good enough job at those at the local level, at the grassroots, and that aside from those big statewide elections, the party really is falling short at the county level and has been steadily losing seats, as you mentioned, in the legislature. Are those fair concerns? Are those fair criticisms?
I understand that criticism, but I think it's important to understand expectations, too. I think a lot of times one of the challenges that we face is when people say that Washington is a blue state. And that's a common cry. And I understand that that's definitely an aspiration, and that's a place we're working toward. But as we know, Washington is not a blue state. It's a purple state. And there are places in this state where where it's very red. And we have to work extra hard in those areas. We have to develop relationships and to show people that we're there to fight for them and to fight for their values.
During this past year, we saw some pretty deep divisions emerging in the party, particularly between Bernie Sanders supporters and Hillary Clinton supporters. How divided or how united do you think the party is right now?
I think there's still a lot of frustration, basically, over how things went, especially earlier this year, with the things that the DNC did, which were definitely unfair to the Sanders campaign. It was clearly the case. And there's just a lot of frustration and hostility. It still remains. It still lingers about that. But I think at this point that we're in a situation where Trump is the president, and you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and we have to stand united. It's not the time for drawing lines in the sand or pointing fingers. We have to stand together to prevent any kind of rollback on some of the things that we've fought so hard for. So we really need to focus on what's going to happen in 2017, focus on flipping the Senate and fighting for our progressive values.
You could probably write a book on what needs to happen now in the Democratic Party, but and we're going to continue this conversation after we say goodbye to you, but leave us with some guiding principles. Where does the party need to go from here?
Well, I think one of the important parts that we need to do is we need to win back the working class. We need to make sure that we relate to voters who shower after work. As you know, we need to basically make sure that we bring back to the table, trust and authenticity, that we build on that, that people don't just want the resources that the party can provide, but they also want respect. So by getting out there in the community, by engaging in the community, by showing that we are the champions for working class families and that we are working hard to make sure that we're fighting for their values and that we're engaged in those communities, that's the way that we're going to be successful.
That was Jackson Ravens, the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, and he was speaking to us from Washington, D.C. So where does the party go from here? We're going to continue that discussion with three people who have differing views on the question. Tamberine Borelli lives in Yelm. She was a Bernie Sanders delegate to the Democratic National Convention, and she ran unsuccessfully for state Senate this year. Jessa Lewis was also a national delegate for Sanders. She's just been elected as a state committee member from King County, and she lives in Seattle. And Alex Stevens is a longtime Democratic Party activist. He serves on the state party's executive board, and he's a civil rights lawyer from Seattle. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Alec, I want to start with you. What's the biggest takeaway for you from this election as a Democrat? What's the biggest lesson for you?
Well, once again, Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line, and we can never forget that. And so I am very concerned and worried that we may get into internecine warfare while the Republicans are coming after all of us in our programs. I hear some people talking about winning back the working class, and I don't like that statement because there are black people who are working class. There are Hispanic people who are the working class. It's almost as if we ignore the vote totals from people of color who are working class. And so I'm very concerned, just given previous history with the Democratic Party, that we pivot so much to white working class people who have no interest in the issues of people of color to try to gain them back. So it cannot be a choice where we're going to go in one direction and tone down the issues that are the other parts of our value to get them back. So it's got to be a way to do it for with everybody at the table and everybody engaged.
Okay, Jessa, does the Democratic Party need to pivot at all? I mean, what kinds of changes does the party need to make?
One of the issues I see is that right now the Democratic mission statement is to elect more Democrats. That's not value driven. That doesn't tell people why. It comes across to people who are economically hurting right now as self-serving. Whereas if instead of our mission statement was to push for economic, social, and environmental justice and convey that in a way that was relatable to people, that would get people to turn out. Because think about it, 45% of people didn't vote. And again, more people on top of that either wrote in a candidate, voted for somebody else, or left that spot blank. And that was enough to determine the election. And I think that there is a judgment that Democrats are not doing enough. We have to be more than, but Trump is bad. And we have to sell a mission and a vision that gets people engaged to show up.
Tamberine, you and Jessa were both Bernie Sanders delegates. Does that vision or mission come from the left? Is that your concern?
The vision of the people, of the everyday people, is absolutely to the left. And I think the root of this problem that we're talking about here and in regard to, you know, the scratching of the head, as Jackson mentioned, which is a little frustrating to me, because how can you look at 73% for a particular candidate?
For Bernie Sanders.
For Bernie Sanders. And all of the elected officials ignored that. And that's just the fact. That's just what happened. And when you do that, when you ignore the people, the grassroots that's being talked about, that we have to pay attention to the grassroots. Well, if we would have paid attention to the grassroots and what the people wanted, maybe we would have been in a different position today than we are right now.
So is the mistake that the party chose the wrong candidate?
The party did not listen to the people that put them in office. And that went all the way down to the state races. And I experienced that firsthand in the state Senate race.
It's a populist year with a growing economic inequality, which impacts everybody. And if we focus on the economics, that's not a race issue. And even it becomes more of a social justice issue because there are certain categories that Democrats are supposed to be protecting that feel this pinch more. And that if that was the message that got this little-known candidate from Vermont to become so popular and so well-loved, and if that was something that was pushed, that definitely would have resonated a lot more with the voters. And instead, there was almost this tone-deaf approach of the multimillion-dollar fundraising parties, celebrity endorsements, and it further fostered the elite narrative and not that we're there. Because, I mean, this was the party of the unions. This was the party of making sure everyone had something to eat, that they had Social Security.
Yes.
And we need to return to the party of FDR.
Yes. And if I can just quickly just jump on that, I'm sorry, just 1 second. If that was what the focus was back in the day, the Democrats were known for those things. But now let me tell you something. In the everyday person's frame of mind, they see the Democratic Party as a party that caters to those that have the money. How can politicians be for your interest if they're being paid exorbitant amounts of money to look after the interests of those billionaires and those multinational corporations? It just doesn't add up.
Alec, what do you think? Is the Democratic Party tone deaf to what's happening at the grassroots?
I think there are issues that we have to address. But for example, I'm going to still say to you that on issues regarding race, just a class analysis doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure we say that when you talk about the people.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a primary as well. We had a primary, not a caucus.
Yes.
And in the primary, the results were different.
But we're a caucus state.
Excuse me.
We're a caucus state.
Would you like me to finish?
If you'd like to finish, go ahead.
I would. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a difference in that outcome. But I look across the country and I look at voting patterns. So we're still going to have to talk about this issue of race. And we're going to have to talk about that because in a number of the primary states, folks didn't go to Bernie. They went to Hillary. For example, Southern primaries, where the response was by Bernie, and it really burned me up. Well, they're conservative, and so I lost there. Excuse me. There were a lot of black voters who voted. There were a lot of progressive white voters who voted. And you just don't say, well, since they didn't come to me, there was something wrong with their politics. So okay. we're going to have to figure out a way to understand where we actually have points of agreement. But I'm still going to say, and I'm going to say it every time, we've got to do this quickly, but we really got to find our way to work together because they're coming after us. One of the first things is going to be a Supreme Court justice. That person likely is going to be horrible across the board for life. And we're going to have to fight that.
All right. We're going to pivot to the state because I want to know how you guys are feeling about how the state party performed this year.
And actually, this feeds into what you're saying, and I definitely want to support you in that. The thing that concerns me the most is that if we look at our local impact on the national scene, nationally, we are one state away from not being able to stop a constitutional amendment, which will impact everybody. And that is not okay. And here in Washington State, we're only holding on by one seat in the House. That's scary to me. And that is a record high number of houses across this country that are held by Republicans. And, you know, next year we've got the 45th, where we have a chance to flip a Senate seat. Like, we're going to have to get a serious ground game, get serious about PCOs, local candidates, and really engage and speak to people because we have to fight for everyone. And definitely, I agree. Like, there is a race issue, and I'm going to promise you, I'm going to stand with you on that.
Is the party doing enough on the grassroots to recruit local candidates, to work in areas that are traditionally Republican areas east of the Cascades? Is the party doing enough?
So for that, I think that there's been an issue that there's been too much focus on the marquee candidates on the top of the ticket, and that instead if we shift to something that's more of a grassroots level focus toward recruiting local candidates that look like the people they serve, that if we're recruiting more PCOs and local people on the level on the local level to drive that engagement, if the money and the resources go to the bottom, then people will vote for the top of the ticket. And that's the biggest thing is we have to have a pipeline, because you think about it, as of this point, we're at a risk right now of having the only white or the only woman of color in the Senate being potentially replaced by a white person. And there's only one person of color that's working in the state office. That is not OK with me. I want the party to be more representative.
Right now, the party is going through a reorganization process, and there are meetings at local levels where new leadership is being elected at the county level, at the district level, and eventually at the state level. What are we going to be seeing in this reorganization effort? How is the party, or is the party going to be changing?
If I can just quickly touch on the last question, because I think it's notable. For instance, in my district, it's rather purple. And just as Jessa suggested, what needs to be done actually was attempted to be done in our race. I was of the people. I'm not a politician. I'm just a regular person. And I ran for state senate. The problem is this. This is classic. Within the party, they brought an establishment Democrat out of retirement 10 minutes before the close of the filing to run against me. And the problem was, as Jackson talked about those voters who never vote, I represented the people who were like, we just want change, for God's sakes. So when that happened, when they threw that Democrat into the race, it split it. When we could have potentially gotten the Senate back, we lost that race. So that is really important for people to really sit with that. We've got to do what Jessa suggested. We have to let these grassroots candidates come up and not try to bring in of yesteryear the old establishment candidates, because people are not going for it. They'll stay home.
Actually, this reminds me, and so one, I hope that's not your last time.
It definitely is not
okay,
my last
because,
time.
Because that reminds me, in 88, after the Jackson campaign, a number of us came forward after that campaign. I hope that is what's happening now, because one of the things that I am concerned about is the drop-off of a number of people in off-year presidential elections. It's only been since 2008, actually, that the youth vote has voted the way when I first was in that vote in 72 we had hoped for. It finally manifested itself in 2008 and in 2012, but it then wasn't there in 2010 and 2014. And so I'm encouraging you to stay at it, because that's what it takes. And certainly stay at it and get involved, especially at your local party. Take them over, your local party organizations. Take them over so that you can exactly do that, but not take the posture of, well, I lost this last time, so I'm done, because that's not the way it's going to happen. It needs to be a continuous, committed effort.
So this will be a continuous, committed conversation that we will, I'm sure, have many, many times over the next few years. Thank you so much for talking with us about the future of the Democratic Party. Alex Stevens, Jessa Lewis, and Tambourine Borelli, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, it's the Republicans' turn to talk about the future of their party. We'll have party chair Susan Hutchison and a panel of Republican activists. That's tomorrow on The Record here on KUOW. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. How thick is the Cascade Curtain? Here in Western Washington, we are wet, urban, and liberal. Eastern Washington is dry, rural, and conservative. That's the stereotype, anyway. Well, there are two state representatives from Spokane who think East and West don't have enough in common to be a part of the same state. Republicans Matt Shea and Bob McCaslin have pre-filed a bill for this legislative session that would break off Eastern Washington into its own state, separate from us here on the West Side. They want to name the new state Liberty. Jim Camden is Olympia bureau chief for the Spokesman Review newspaper based in Spokane. He told me this proposal isn't new or anything we should take seriously.
It has a long history of being introduced and never getting very far. It dates back in terms of legislative proposals, at least to 1915. And you might notice that the state is still intact. So I don't think that you take it seriously as something that will happen, but more as a reflection of the fact that some people in eastern Washington don't feel that they are very well represented in the state as a whole.
Yeah, talk more about that. What is the feeling that informs this kind of movement for secession?
Well, if east of the Cascades is primarily Republican red and west of the Cascades is more Democratic blue. So eastern Washington is more rural. It has a more resource-based economy. It is less populated for the most part compared to western Washington, which is more metropolitan. So it's also a lot rainier over here. So maybe on the dry side of the state, these ideas hatch differently.
But it's not just the fact that we have different economies or that we look different or the different climates, but this is more of a sense of the state is not fair to eastern Washington. Would that be a fair assumption?
There are people who say that we pay all our taxes and they go to the west side of the state and they don't come back. I think most studies show that the majority of counties in eastern Washington actually get back more from the state than they pay in. But it's also a fact that they feel farther away from the state capital and the main centers of population. So the distance may add some of that feeling of, hey, you're forgetting about us most of the time.
All right, so let's take it seriously and think about what this might mean if it ever became law. What would the state of liberty look like? I mean, would it have its own separate capital? And what would its economy look like, for example?
Well, the proposal is to turn it into a state, so you would have to have a state capital.
Okay.
You would get two U.S. senators, and I would assume you would get two members of the House of Representatives, because there are two members of the House of Representatives in eastern Washington right now. It would be a more rural state. It would be a resource-based economy, agriculture. There are wheat farms and apple orchards and cattle ranches, and the Hanford Nuclear Reservation is in the Tri-Cities. But, I mean, the boundaries would still be Canada, Oregon, and Idaho. Three of the boundaries would be the same. And there would just be a sign, I guess, at the top of Snoqualmie Pass that would say, now entering Washington or now entering Liberty.
Is this just a statement of protest that happens, you know, with regularity in the legislature? Or do you think there really is some popular support for this kind of idea out in eastern Washington?
Well, I don't know how easy it is to judge the popular support. It is a point of talking about. It is not a serious proposal in the sense that people think that it would go all the way through. It's more like a wish list sort of thing. Western Washington legislators propose a similar bit of legislation back in 1991. Some Westsiders got together, and they were apparently tired of these proposals to split things. So they proposed splitting it and putting the capital in Ritzville and coming up with sort of snarky ideas like the state tree should be a telephone pole.
So what should we here in Western Washington be thinking about all of these repeated attempts by half the state to leave us? I mean, should we be taking this personally?
No, I don't think so, because they're not the kind of things that are actually going to happen. But I think what they might suggest is that, hey, why don't you go over to the eastern side of the state so that you know what's over there, because Eastsiders are much more likely to come over to the west side than I think Westsiders are to go to the east side. So I know a lot of people in Seattle who think that there is nothing between Seattle and Spokane but desert, which isn't really true, because there's a beautiful river gorge, the Columbia River Gorge. The state is pretty diverse, and you should get around if mostly what you do is spend your time in Seattle or Tacoma and driving up and down I-5.
Jim Camden is Olympia Bureau Chief for the Spokesman Review, based in Spokane. We'll tweet out a link to his stories at KUOW. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. We'll be back in a minute. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. In late October, we learned that Olympia-based writer Lucia Perillo had died at the age of 58. She was a MacArthur Genius Award winner, and she wrote 7 poetry collections, including the Pulitzer finalist Inseminating the Elephant. KUOW's poetry correspondent Elizabeth Austin spoke with Bill Ratke about Lucia Perillo's poetry.
Well, in addition to the poetry collections, she also wrote a collection of short stories and a collection of essays titled I've Heard the Vultures Singing, Field Notes on Poetry, Illness, and Nature. So Lucia had trained as a wildlife biologist, and she worked as a ranger on Mount Rainier before she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis at age 30, right before her first book of poems was published. And she remained a sharp observer of the natural world, though she had to be increasingly inventive about how she got there once she needed a wheelchair.
What's the poem that you've chosen for us?
Bill, I have to tell you, I really struggled about what poem to bring because I really love Lucia's work. Should I bring you Lucia the cultural critic or Lucia the dark humorist, the lyric poet, the nature poet? Because you're going to find all of that and more in her final collection, which is called Time Will Clean the Carcass Bones, Selected and New Poems, which Copper Canyon published just earlier this year. But I decided to bring in a poem that's about what Lucia described in an interview as her favorite subject, which is rot.
Her favorite subject is rot.
Yes, R-O-T.
What do you think she meant by that? I have some idea based on what you've told us.
She means exactly what it sounds like, decay. She was somebody who looked mortality head on, not at all sentimental. So this is a poem that I recorded way back in 2006, and it was one of many readings that Lucia gave at Open Books, the poetry-only bookstore in Wallingford. The poem is called Chum, as in chum salmon. So here's Lucia Perillo.
A number of years ago, I worked on a project with a photographer named Scott Chambers, and he lives in the Methow Valley, and he has Huntington's disease. So he had taken a number of pictures of dead salmon, and he called his series Bardo. Bardo is that state between life and death. I was thinking specifically of the paintings of Alfredo Aragon, and he has, in the cover of Raymond Carver's book, a painting of salmon, and they have the ghost salmon kind of floating back downstream. Chum, how come we all don't have the luxury of our ghosts, the way some paintings of salmon show their spectral versions flying? License, you might say, for the artist to put dead fish in the sky, instead of leaving them as they are when you see them wilting in the eddy, 2 tons of major spent sex stink. Yet see how everyone skips so giddily around the trail, eyeballing the spawning from the cedar bridge, as if they're sure we will be cohorts in the rapture about which the bumper stickers speak, as if we really will ascend someday to swim among the fishes. All of us, see how good we are, so careful not to kick stones down into the creek. I'm just trying to get a handle on how it would be if we made love one time in our lives after days spent on the interstate, before we lay down to die so publicly in shallow pools, while the other forms pass by and point to educate their frenzied children. See the odd species. They chose love.
Beautiful. That's the late Lucia Perillo reading her poem, Chum. I love that she doesn't hand-wring about life and death and rot, as you said.
Yeah, she takes that and looks at what's actually happening. She doesn't romanticize what we're seeing.
And Elizabeth, I'm talking with Elizabeth Austin. This is KOW's poetry correspondent. And you mentioned, Elizabeth, that you had trouble choosing which poem of Lucia's to bring. Why did you choose that one?
Because in just those 3 short stanzas, it carries so much of what makes Lucia's voice distinctive and memorable. So, you know, if that title and opening line makes you think that this is going to be a sentimental salmon poem, she skewers that illusion pretty early on when she describes the spawned out salmon as wilting in the eddy, 2 tons of major spent sex stink.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she
turns. That's great.
Isn't it? I mean, it's and the thing is that it's pleasurable to say, even though what she's talking about is death itself, but
right.
it just in the mouth to say it.
And you're not removed from it.
No, no, she's putting us nose first into
there
it,
you
right?
Go.
And then she flips it around and looks at us as we skip so giddily around the trail, eyeballing the spawning from this cedar bridge. And then she just flips it around to something very unexpected. This last stanza, she writes, "I'm just trying to get a handle on how it would be if we made love one time in our lives after days spent on the interstate, before we lay down to die so publicly in shallow pools, while the other forms pass by and point to educate their frenzied children. See the odd species. They chose love."
Brings tears to my eyes. Maybe we wouldn't distance ourselves from death if we felt as close to it as maybe Lucia did later in her life. She did. She's not. It's not some faraway thing that we avert our eyes from.
No, and she succeeds in putting it back on us, that she leaves you and I to consider this. She's not going to tidy anything up for us.
We are going to tweet out a link to a reading that Lucia Perillo gave a couple of years ago for Seattle Arts and Lectures.
Mm-hmm.
It was on featured on KUOW Presents not long ago. In fact, you can find links to more of Lucia Perillo's work if you want to get to know her better. That's at our website, KUOW.org. And, Elizabeth, I understand there's a celebration of Lucia Perillo's life and work this Sunday in Olympia?
There is, and we'll put the information about that on the website as well.
Our poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke, and we're live tweeting at KUOW. So it's Wednesday, which means we get to talk about our neighbors to the north with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. And Vaughn, let's just start out talking about U.S.-Canada relations. Vice President Joe Biden is headed to Canada next week, ahead of the transition to a Trump administration. What's on his agenda?
Lots to talk about, and we're kind of anxious up here about how this Trump thing is going to work out. You know, I know you're all relaxed, no issues at all, but yeah, we're kind of anxious. So we've got Biden coming in. That's to talk about border security, climate action. Canada's working on a plan to allow us to meet our targets under the Paris Climate Accord. Of course, Canada got along really well with President Obama on that issue. I don't know how we're going to get along with Trump, but anyway, this is kind of a wrap-up meeting with the American government, the outgoing administration, and we're looking for some reassurances from Biden on some things, maybe a few pointers on how to get along with the next president. So that's, I think we were kind of, this thing was probably planned back when we were thinking, oh, it's going to be Clinton, right? So I'm not sure how much we should be hedging on Biden, but anyway, this is an important meeting. I don't want to make too light of it. Canada and the United States, obviously, we have to get along, not just on border security, but climate action. I think there would be a mistake. It's thought it would be a mistake here for us to go too far down the road to carbon pricing and emissions controls if the United States isn't going to be going there as well, because our two economies work so closely together that, you know, Canadians would be concerned if there were tax and regulatory advantages in the United States, and we might have to change our plans to work more closely with the United States.
Well, your Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, and President Obama have had a close relationship. They see eye to eye on a lot of issues. So what's the, you know, what are you worried about now? I mean, is there a sense that people expect that the relationship is going to change dramatically?
Oh, I think it will change dramatically. We're a little weird, you know, these two countries side by side. We get along on so many things and we share so many things. But over the last 20 years or so, there's been a pattern that when you elect a conservative like Bush, we have a liberal, we had Chrétien, and then we elected Harper, who was a conservative, just before you switched to Obama, who was a liberal. And then last year, We elected a liberal who was just going to dovetail perfectly with Obama and Trudeau, so we get Trudeau, and then you guys switch to Trump. So we're not exactly on the same political cycle, and, you know, Trudeau was looking forward to working with Obama and Obama's successor, who, as I said, they were expecting a Democrat. And instead, we're going to have to figure out how to get along with Trump. Now, we're not alone in the world in terms of that. I think there's probably a lot of Americans who are trying to figure that out as well. So we're curious. I'll tell you that there's a lot of attention up here to a scheduled speech in early January by Kellyanne Conway. She's going to speak in Calgary in Alberta. She's being brought up here by a conservative think tank, and Canadians will be paying very close attention to whatever she says. She'll be speaking there, what, about a week and a half before Trump takes, just a little under 8 days before Trump takes the oath of office.
Yeah, so how did, what is the timing of this? So Kellyanne Conway was Mr. Trump's campaign manager, now advisor on his transition. She'll be coming not only to speak, but to tour the oil sands.
Yeah.
So what's this all about?
See that in Alberta. This is, as I say, it's a conservative, it's one of our, I guess sort of the closest thing I could say is it's kind of our version of a political action committee is bringing her up. Mm. And they're bringing her up. They're trying to set up a tour of the oil sands in Alberta. So Trump, Obama killed the pipeline that was going to bring Alberta oil, more Alberta oil to the United States.
This is the Keystone XL pipeline?
That's right.
Okay.
So Obama killed it, but Trump says he's going to reactivate it. So, and in fact, I think it's high on his agenda for when he takes office in January. So the Alberta, this group in Alberta is bringing her up here to give a speech, but you're right, Deb, they're also going to take her on a tour of the oil sands, show her what's being done there in terms of cleaning it up and managing emissions and all that. And, you know, I think as, given the implications for Canadian economy, I mean, oil is still one of our biggest export products, and we feel like we're not able to get as much of it out there as we would like. We're trying to line up customers overseas as well, which is why we're talking about building a pipeline to Vancouver. But if Keystone is going to be back up and running, Alberta has an interest in that. And I guess by giving her, Kellyanne Conway, a tour, they're kind of hoping they might have some influence on how the Trump administration sees the challenge of opening up that pipeline again.
All right. Well, so you have folks in the energy sector who are happy about a Trump presidency. Who else up in Canada is happy about a Trump presidency? Who else benefits?
Oh, I think most people are kind of worried about it. We're dealing softwood lumber. The agreement to manage the trade between the two countries expired back in October, not the best possible timing. We're expecting a very rough ride getting that renewed. The American lumber industry has already launched a trade action against Canadian lumber, so we're probably looking at, if we're lucky, some kind of agreement to manage the trade. We may be looking at significant trade penalties. Border security is an issue. Now, I mean, we've been working very, very hard with the Obama administration to ease the movement of goods and people across the border. But again, I know Trump's paid more attention to the southern border of the United States. But Canada's great fear always, Deb, is that we'll be kind of, a policy will be launched to take care of a problem with some other country, but because Canada and the United States work so closely together on so many things, it will be like almost collateral damage to whatever the policy is that was actually targeting somebody else. For example, if the president decides to reopen NAFTA, that would affect Canada as well, even if his main target is Mexico.
So you were talking earlier about how we're on these opposite political cycles. We have a conservative, you have a liberal, you have a conservative, we have a liberal. And so I wonder if you could argue that, you know, we've gone through these political cycles before and somehow our relationship seems to survive. So could you argue that this is not such a big deal?
Canada and the United States have worked together more often than they've fallen apart. I mean, we were in World War II 2 years before you were. You were in Vietnam. We were opposed We joined you in the first Gulf War and opposed taking part in the second one. So we've been through, you're right, some very rough times, and I think we'll get along. We're kind of hoping that mainly the president will end up so preoccupied with problems elsewhere in the world that he'll just kind of ignore us, and there are probably worse things than just being ignored by an American president.
All right. Well, Vaughn, we'll have to keep an eye on that, and we'll keep in touch with you to see how it goes along. Vaughn Palmer with the Vancouver Sun, thanks for speaking with us.
Bye-bye.
It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong.